This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize.
All right. Hello and welcome. You've landed here in this week's gathering of TGIF DCT, whether you're listening here live on Clubhouse or whether you're joining us through our replays on Clubhouse or on your favorite podcast platform. Remember, these episodes are dropped weekly as the Decentralized Podcast, shared out on Spotify or whatever your favorite podcast platform may be. But we do gather here live every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern time, with different guests on different topics, all related to improving access and clinical research, sharing ideas, sharing experiences, sharing data. If there's a topic you'd love to see us cover in the weeks ahead, feel free to drop a message to myself, to Jane Miles. You can use the Clubhouse app. You can use LinkedIn, X, email. If you don't know how to reach us through any of those channels, that's okay. You can always send an email to secretariat@dtra.org and share a topic you'd love to see us cover, or make like Todd, Jennifer, and Brandon, and join us here on stage as one of our guests. You may have an experience you want to dig into together. You may have some data that you're sharing. You may have a publication you're dropping like our friend Todd did. And this is a great opportunity to dig deeper with the authors. Our format remains the same. We'll have a conversation here for the first half hour. We'll be keeping an eye on the chat for any shares or observations from our audience. The second half hour, we'll open up the room and look forward to hearing from you with your questions, experiences, and the like. Jane Miles, how are you doing today? Are you ready for today's topic?
I am more than ready. Like, I love this topic. I can't wait to dive in.
Well, this week's topic is a great build on a paper that was dropped in Applied Clinical Trials by our friend Todd Georgieff. So why don't we get the conversation going by turning over to you, Todd, and if you don't mind introducing yourself for our audience and share a little bit about what triggered you to write the paper, Clinical Trial Matching Solutions, Understanding the Landscape, which we've also pinned here at the top of your screen in Clubhouse. Todd, welcome.
Thanks, Craig, and thanks, Jane and Amir, and DTRA for inviting us to join you here today. I wanted to start by saying that, first of all, today's TGIF DCT is not about decentralized trials, but I think you're going to hear that a lot of the considerations of sort of enabling trial matching are pretty identical to the same considerations and the same obstacles that have to be overcome to enable decentralized trials. And I'm really thinking about things like, you know, real-time data interoperability, and at the end of the day, you know, spoiler alert, where a lot of these matching solutions fall down is kind of in the last mile. It's even if you get all of that data interoperability correct, the hard part is actually making it happen in real life. So in terms of like background, I mean, this is also a pretty popular topic. If the number of clinical trial matching vendors that are appearing on the landscape is any sign. There are a number of different approaches, maybe because this sounds like an easy problem to solve, but there are a number of different approaches. While I was at Roche, I spent a couple of years leading the clinical trial matching work stream of something called the Precision Cancer Consortium, which was a group of seven large pharma companies who wanted to see, could we develop a sort of common shared platform or a common shared approach, I should say, to be able to do sort of matching across our respective portfolios of targeted therapies based on comprehensive genomic profiling, for example. Spoiler alert, if you're trying to do that in a vendor agnostic and diagnostic vendor agnostic kind of a way, it ends up being like a data interoperability problem. While we were doing that, there became kind of a running joke that, you know, every month or so, we'd learn about two or three other vendors that we hadn't heard from before or heard of before. And I mean, part of the joke was that no two looked alike. Each of the vendors has a slightly different approach to the problem. So that's where, you know, as we started to meet and think about the different vendors that we were seeing, that's where this kind of taxonomy of different vendors and a way of thinking about the vendors emerged. And that was sort of the impetus for me putting it down in the article in Applied Clinical Trials. So what I was trying to do with the article was sort of lay out a way of thinking about all of the different vendors on the clinical trial matching landscape, as kind of a way to help you and to help other people think about what they're looking at when they come across a clinical trial matching vendor. So what we're going to do today is I'm going to start by framing the conversation by sort of walking through some of the high-level elements in the article. I'll talk a little bit about sort of the value proposition. I'll talk about some of the other elements in the article. Then I'm also going to talk about some things that are not mentioned in the article, but I think are going to occur to you along the way as being important or potentially important to the matching landscape. And I'm really lucky to be joined by a couple of relatively new friends, Brandon Lee, who's the CEO and founder of Power, sort of a patient-centered matching platform, and Jen Clausen, who is the VP of Research Partnerships with a company called Diania Health. Brandon and Jennifer, do you guys want to introduce yourself just real briefly, and then I'll jump back in? Maybe Brandon first.
Yeah, happy to go. Hey, first of all, thanks for inviting me to be here. Really excited to have this conversation. I'll kind of tee this up with, we actually don't think of ourselves as a clinical trial matching solution. We think of ourselves much more as a modern patient recruitment marketplace or a modern clinical trial marketplace. The central idea is, how do you improve access, discovery, connectivity for patients who are looking for trials? But happy to get into that in much more detail throughout the course of this conversation.
Thanks, Brandon.
Jennifer?
Hi, I'm Jen Clausen. So glad to be invited here today. Looking forward to this conversation. So Diania Health is an AI as a service company where our product can apply reasoning and clinical judgment to medical data, unstructured medical data. One and our first use case that we have tackled is matching for clinical trials in EMR data, where our product can do in half a second what it would take otherwise a clinical person about 30 minutes of reviewing charts, sifting through information, and coming to some conclusions about eligibility, so that we can really streamline and focus the clinicians on managing patients on studies and a lot less time sifting through tranches of medical data to make sense of it.
Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation. And Todd, I am going to just Do one listener note, TGIF DCT, this program, DTRA in general, it's all about access. And so your topic today is spot on for this audience. And I'm really looking forward to digging in with you around the framework you've laid out. In particular, I love the way you're calling out, and I'll be interested to hear more color on patient-centric versus trial-centric matching, especially in a time when jargon like patient-centric is so overused in many ways. I think this is an important distinction for many when they're thinking about the different solutions out there.
Thanks, Craig. Yeah, that's a really important place to start, I think. And maybe that's a sort of a logical way to start, is to think about what's the starting point. So is the starting point of the clinical trial matching approach a patient who's looking, a patient or a caregiver or a group of patients, like a patient advocacy group, who are looking for trials that might be suitable for them? Or is the starting point, you know, a pharma company with either one or portfolio of trials that they're sponsoring, or maybe even a healthcare provider institution that has their own portfolio of trials that are going on kind of under their roof, where they want to find the patients that match the trials. So when we say sort of patient-centric versus trial-centric, that's what I mean by sort of, you know, we're not pretending automatically that those patient-centric things are automatically patient-centric the way we think of the sense of patient centricity. It's really just about the starting point. So that's kind of the first axis that I think about. Is it a kind of a patient-centric approach or a trial-centric approach? And then right adjacent to that question is, as you're looking at a clinical trial matching solution, one of the first questions you ask yourself is, well, who's the intended sort of customer? Is the customer the patient? Is it a group of patients, like an advocacy group? Is it a healthcare provider institution, like a hospital network or an individual healthcare provider? Or is it some kind of a trial sponsor, whether it's, you know, the NCI or, you know, a pharma company or something like that? So that's the first couple of characteristics. And, you know, when you take a step back, you think the value proposition and the problem statement sounds pretty simple. I mean, what I've got is I've got a list of patient characteristics, either me individually or my group of patients, and I've got a list of eligibility criteria, either for one clinical trial or for many clinical trials. So how hard can it be really just to do like a match of like, how many patients or how many of the eligibility criteria do the patients meet? And therefore, can I, identify trials that are potentially suitable for that particular patient or those particular patients? Go ahead, Craig.
Todd, one of the areas that I always struggled with when I was on sort of the buy side in pharma is that there's this tension. I would question, is it ethical? And not from an IRB approval perspective, but just from a human perspective, is it ethical to launch websites that are purely protocol-centric, purely trial-centric, where we're pulling patients away potentially from platforms that can give them more objective and balanced lens on all the trials for which they may be eligible, and only showing them the trial that I want them to see? But the tension to me is, I can empathize with entrepreneurs and builders in this space, that you need to keep the lights on and you need to be able to generate, you know, revenue at some place in the process, which usually comes by stimulating referrals into studies for which you're contracted. And so maybe, Brendan, you can shed some light on this. Is this a tension that you as an innovator in this space have struggled with, and how have you found a place to land?
Yeah, Craig, I'm so glad you went in this direction. That's exactly, I think, the kind of first question we have to ask ourselves here, especially if we're trying to design something from a patient-centric standpoint. So for the folks who are less familiar with Power, tongue-in-cheek, I kind of tell people that we are replacing clinicaltrials.gov. But what I really mean is that I think what we're building is the best product on the internet for patients, caregivers, loved ones who are interested in learning about clinical trials as an option. So you can think of it as a Zillow or an Airbnb for clinical trials. It's study and sponsor agnostic, but the goal is to create a really modern experience that simplifies clinical trial jargon into plain English, and makes discovery of trials far, far easier. That's kind of the first starting point. So Craig, to your point, we looked at our kind of business plan, business model, and made the intentional decision up front to say, well, we think that we are going to do what's right for patients and build this agnostic platform as a starting point. And our belief is that if we build the best product for patients will use it, we'll find a way to acquire and get in front of patients. And then if we do that, then we will earn the right to help studies in a way that is impactful for them.
But quick pause there, Brendan, because something tells me when you went out with a pitch deck for investors, there was a landscape slide in there. Maybe it was a 2x2 and your concept would be in the top right. But clearly, there have been
Never.
a lot of folks out there that aspired to build the better CT.gov. What
Sure.
made you believe that there was a better solution than the graveyard of well-intended solutions that predated?
Yeah, no, that's a really, really good question. And I think actually it comes down to a question of why now, right? We're not the first people to have acknowledged this problem. I think that anybody on this call will have gone through clinicaltrials.gov and asked, well, there must be a better way to do this. And I think the why now actually is in 2021, when we first launched this website, it was on the advent of GPT-3. And what we realized was that we could use these large language models to help make clinical trials information more accessible to the everyday user. And that's what we saw when we launched the product. We were able to launch it with far more plain English about these clinical trials. And we were the fastest growing website ever launched in this space. And that really resonated for patients, just having far more accessible even information on the platform.
So can I chime in with a question, Brandon? Because in the chat, you can see Craig and I went down this road a long time ago. It didn't
Sure.
work out. And I'm really curious. One of the things that was hard way back then was really trying to surface what are the match options and then help guide the patient through how do you decide what's the right option for you as a patient? So how are you solving for that at Power?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, there's probably two ways that you could approach this problem. Way number one is what I would call platform-driven match, trying to gather as much information from the individual as possible and present the absolute best options, right? This is kind of like what an Uber approach on a marketplace would traditionally be. Platform kind of tries to make the decision because it has perfect information. Unfortunately, we're in a space that you can't have perfect decision making as a platform. Each individual has different sets of circumstances, and even if you had perfect information about their kind of medical history, which we don't, you wouldn't have perfect information about their personal context. Do they have a family member in another city that they would rather stay with? Do they have like access to kind of transportation locally? These kinds of things. So, in those kinds of situations, the kind of marketplace model that we've seen to be the most successful is what we would call user-driven match. So that's more of like an Airbnb style match where the platform's goal is to surface viable options, stack ranked in viability, but viable, the world of viable options, and to present as much information and context to the individual so that they can navigate and spend some time looking at different options. The best example that I like to use is, hey, if you went onto Airbnb and you're booking a place for a vacation, you'd actually be really mad if they asked you 20 questions and you just got one place that you could book. Right, because it's a deeply personal decision, and I think that's even more true in health. It's a deeply personal decision. So platforms like ours, I think, need to present a world of options quickly, and then help individuals narrow that down.
I really love that user-centered feature set that you put in there because you're exactly right. The drivers are going to be so different even in a similar diagnosis. So thank you for thinking of that. How, just out of curiosity, how does that sit with the research sponsors, or do they have a say in how the information is presented? I'm not clear on that at all.
Yeah, it's a great question. So twofold. I would say, I'll do a little myth busting on behalf of the sponsors out there. I think sponsors are actually far more open to the idea of sharing the surface area with other sponsors than we might imagine, at least in the conversations I've had. And maybe this is selection bias because the folks who decide to talk to me are the ones who are excited about the approach we've taken. But we certainly have had plenty of conversations with sponsors where they've acknowledged, you know what, I think this is a better solution for patients. And if it's a better solution for patients, ultimately it'll be a better solution for us as sponsors.
I want to pull Jennifer into the conversation. Brendan, I have 100 more questions for you, but fortunately we have still more time together. Jennifer, I know you heard Todd's opening, and I know you've had a chance to think through some of his framework that he's laid out. What are your reflections so far on the conversation here? And by the way, please introduce, oh, you already did. Share some of your reflections on the conversation so far.
I will. And when about the question of who is the customer, I think the answer is yes. We're, you know, all of the stakeholders you mentioned are customers, and trying to balance and align all of the incentives is, you know, the holy grail that, you know, we're all chasing. And I should probably take a step back and disclose my biases. So I spent the majority of my career working in clinical trial operations within health systems, close to the patients, close to the doctors, the nurses, the researchers, the scientists. And I ended up on the vendor side really because of a combination of deep love and bone-weary irritation for how inefficient our patient identification and pre-screening processes were. So I want to remark, you know, to follow up on the questions about presenting patient information about trials. Trial information to patients on a platform versus via their physician. There are types of trials where I think it's incredibly important and very appropriate and ethical to go direct to patient. There are other trials where I think it would be a very poor choice to do so. And I have, as a clinical trial director, I've worked in all of these different therapeutic areas, all the different trials, all the different patient outreach methods. So the type of trial that lends itself very well to a direct-to-patient, I'll give an example of one where it was very difficult to do this in a hospital setting. The study was for depression. It was to add on a medication to the patient's existing regimen. And for a lot of reasons, which I can get into later if people are interested, there's a lot of internal health system barriers to get to those folks. And this is a setting where mental health services in Illinois, there was a waiting list of, at the time, I think it was like 9 to 12 months. So we knew in our health system, there were patients who were being medicated for depression in a way that you could not find it in with EMR codes, who were not even seeing a psychiatrist, but working with a GP, or a lot of OB-GYNs, believe it or not, will prescribe depression meds. And we had no way to get to those patients to tell them, hey, you know what, here's another option where we're not going to change your meds, but we're going to add a new one. And we, you know, so in that scenario, I would 100% want a direct to patient so they are aware that this option exists. Now, on the side of things where the AI is incredibly good, it's for, you know, medically complex, rapidly changing conditions like in oncology, where you have to find someone who has a very specific order of events in the very moment in the window of time where they are potentially eligible for a trial, which is when their current treatment is failing. And they have surgery planned in 2 weeks, and their adverse event of brain mets are stabilizing, and they are finishing a washout period. That is the scenario where I personally am very opposed to going direct to patient, because that trial is not their only option. It should be considered with the whole range of other trials and treatment options, and really a no treatment option. Because there are patients, even if they're eligible, you would not want to put them on, you know, an early phase trial. So I think there's cases where both of these approaches are very effective, but in different ways.
Yeah, Jennifer, I could debate with you on that only because there are so many oncology patients who never know there's an option. So I agree that even in a direct-to-patient setting, there needs to be a whole lot of connection with the healthcare provider to determine what's the best option. But I'm sure, just like you, you've been on the phone with a whole lot of people who are looking for options and don't know how to find them.
Well, exactly. And one way, one of our customers has a really, they have an existing, you know, people who are combing through medical records looking for potentially eligible patients. And they have a whole system where through their EMR, through their patient digital experience, they can push a notification to the patient to say, hey, do you want to learn more about this? You might look eligible. Let's go talk to your doctor. Because you're right, it is very difficult to make sure that every patient who's in the health system is presented with every option. And there's a lot of operational reasons why that doesn't happen. However, to lean on some technology to help the people within the health system trade that information with each other and with the patient, that I think is a better route so that they can help get assessed what their best option is in a holistic manner.
Yeah, and I'll just add on to that as well, because to me what this is setting up is a question about what are the endpoints of the matching algorithm as well. I mean, the goal is certainly to be able to present these options to patients and have patients who are, you know, being considered. And the idea of the matching solution is to be able to identify higher probability, higher quality potential matches. But at the end of the day, and you know, in full transparency, this is something that when we were, you know, at the Precision Cancer Consortium, we probably spent several months before we articulated this for ourselves to say, you know, at the end of the of a matching transaction, the endpoint is not a patient who's locked in and now, you know, enrolled in a clinical trial and doesn't have a choice. The end of a matching transaction is hopefully a really good and well-informed conversation between an investigative site and a patient to figure out, is this the best treatment option or the best trial option for that patient? And there's, you know, a lot of reasons that it may not be, a lot of reasons that have nothing to do with how well the patient meets the eligibility criteria, even if they are within geographic reach. There's lots of other reasons that may tilt the decision away from participating in the trial for that patient.
Just going to say it. What makes so much sense to me is that, you know, being able to have a holistic discussion like this so that, you know, because really you have to attack both ends of the decision at the patient side and on the healthcare system side. So, you know, being able to use the universe of vendors in a really intelligent way, it just, you know, it moves the needle for everyone.
We're just at the halfway mark. And time is flying. We are gathered this week discussing clinical trial matching solutions with Todd, Jennifer, and Brandon. If you just joined us, welcome. You've landed in TGIF DCT, our weekly gathering here on Clubhouse. Remember, if you're listening through the podcast, we do gather here every Friday. It's a great way to switch from just replay mode to participation mode, just like we're about to hear. For folks that are here with us in the audience, if you have questions, experiences that you'd like to bring into the conversation, now's your chance. Feel free to take advantage of your little hand-raising icon or whatever it looks like on your screen, and we'll welcome you up here to the stage. I do see an interesting question, though, that is popped up in the chat that is probably worth bringing over here to our conversation. In the chat, it's noted by Kevin that really people people aren't looking, are people really looking for sticky engagements when it comes to recruitment and learning about clinical trials? It seems the way I sense this question, most people don't want to be in a clinical trial. If they're going to be in a clinical trial, they hope that they're only in one and that they get what they need out of the experience. Is there really a stickiness for engaging with patients around trial matching, or is this really just a transaction for them, one that may take a fair amount of time, but is their aspiration that this is one and done? Todd or Brendan, anyone want to jump in on that one? Brendan?
Yeah, happy to jump in here. Hey, I resonate with this, right? Like in an ideal world, the folks who are using our platform don't need to be using our platform. Right. The way that we think about it is not like a social app. We're not Facebook. We're not solving for daily active users. We're not solving for minutes spent on platform. That's not what we're doing here. We're trying to get them to the best result possible as fast as possible. And I think, Todd, what you were talking about really resonated, which is actually the end goal should be a really thoughtful, informed conversation with the clinical trial site, the PI, the team over there, to help consider whether this is a good idea for that individual. And that's how we've aligned a lot of our kind of processes as well, to try to minimize what we call the speed to kind of first appointment.
Thanks so much, Brandon. And thanks for sharing the question in the audience in the chat. Kevin, if you have a build on that and you want to jump on stage, feel free to take advantage. You know, one sense that I have from so much of the conversation so far is this question on my mind around misaligned economic incentives, the freakonomics of clinical trial matching. Is there an economic model that's sustainable for patient-centric matching platforms, given that most of the study matches that you might make will be with trials that aren't sponsored? Or paying for those referrals? Is there an economic incentive for stimulating referrals when we're looking at providers inside of a health system, Jennifer, like you were mentioning earlier, to encourage stimulating referrals when doing so, maybe sending away RVUs, the ways that providers are being paid? And in some practices, those referrals may be looked at as leaking patients. Todd, Jennifer, Brendan, Todd, do you want to opine a bit on these misaligned incentives?
I mean, I can start a little bit because those kind of three different customer types that I mentioned before kind of lead into what we see in the landscape as well, which there are different sort of business models as well, where some of them look a lot like or aim to be a lot like many other sort of enrollment solutions as well, where one of the things that they strive to do is to say, you know, don't pay us unless the patient ends up in the trial or ends up consenting for the trial or is presented with the consent form. So we only, you know, will our business model will be only for patients who are actually screened, whether they screen fail or not. But if we get them to the front door and it's a good enough match, that's going to be the basis of a sort of a chargeable transaction. Others, on the other hand, what they'll do is they'll have they'll be measuring sort of higher level metrics. So, for example, if you're a healthcare system that's doing a lot of clinical trials and you think that using an information system based approach like this will help you to optimize the number of patients in your patient population who are being presented with trials as an option, but that's a different sort of business that implies a different business model than simply the number of trials that match in any one of the multiple trials that are representing multiple sponsors as well. And we've seen both. The other business model is, you know, when the customer is the sponsor, you know, you were talking, Craig, a little bit about sort of what's the set of trials that ends up on the platform, on the matching platform as well. And a couple of the platforms that I'm aware of will actually have almost two tiers of clinical trials that are on their platform. So there'll be, you know, the base level tier is kind of everything in ct.gov, where using AI or some kind of an automation technology, they'll pull all of everything from ct.gov and have a sort of an exhaustive as possible representation of all of the trials that might be available for that particular condition. But then there may be a subset of trials that have what I'll call, you know, enriched data. They'll have much more detailed data because there's been an interaction directly with the trial sponsor or directly with the clinical research site, and then they've put a lot more detail and depth in for the eligibility criteria, the selection criteria for the patient that we're actually looking for. And as you know, those of us who have lived with eligibility criteria for a long time know, sometimes it's not really clear. You know, you've got a bunch of run-on sentences and, you know, 20 or 40 different eligibility criteria, only a subset of which really matter. And it's sometimes very difficult to know what does this patient really look like in real life. So how do you do that in a scalable way based on information technology?
Jennifer, can you build on this conversation around misaligned economic incentives, especially where you're reflecting on your experience within a healthcare setting, within health systems? Even stimulating referrals within a health system can seem insurmountable. Nevertheless, if the patient matches better with a trial that's across the street.
Oh, yes, I do have so much to say about this. I should frame. So my first experience on the vendor side after exiting the health system was working with Tempus. And our idea that we put into motion was called the time trial. So we were doing matching on genomic data and unstructured patient data for, you know, patients that we were performing genomic testing for. And we built on top of that a just-in-time site activation network for molecularly targeted trials. So, and we were actually able to get the site activation down to 10 days, which was just, I mean, if I would have, you know, said that to someone a few years ago, they would just laugh in my face. So the misaligned incentives sometimes come when, you know, so in that scenario, we were only able to match to the trials that we had pharma contracts for. So there could be a multiple molecularly targeted trials, but we were only matching for a few. The other thing that we did do was if the trial was not open, and that's one of those last mile issues, if the trial we were contracted for was not open at the site where the patient was being seen, we would match them to all the sites that were nearby, who they could go to. And it is maddening that there are times where the patient cannot walk across the street to get into the study. I'll give you a specific example. This patient was a public pay patient. A lot of their medical care was subsidized by their state. And the trial they were eligible for was literally a few blocks away at an academic medical center whose contract with the sponsor relied on insurance payment covering a good deal of the schedule of events, the scans, the oncology consults, the infusion room. So they literally could not accept that patient into that hospital because they had no contract to pay for their services. And I should say their payment, their public pay was specific to the public hospital. It wasn't transferable to a private hospital. And so here we are. I mean, they were literally less than half a mile in geography and were in a completely different universe in terms of that very last mile.
Very interesting here. I'm taking a look here in the questions in the chat. Jane, are any questions in the chat jumping out at you right now?
I see one here from Priya. And Priya, you can join us on stage if you want. Her question is, how does this work at larger versus smaller practices? And is there an issue that you've managed to overcome with interoperability, especially getting those smaller guys involved. That's how I'm interpreting it. So, Priya, if I got that wrong, raise your hand.
Maybe that's another one back to you, Jennifer, thinking about the different size practices that you might engage with some of these approaches.
Yes. Well, this raises one of the challenges of what our approach is, because we install behind the healthcare system's firewall, which is solves a host of problems in that we're not extracting data. We're not selling data. We're not licensing it. We're running within the healthcare system, providing insights directly to them. So there's a lot of excellent advantages for that reason. However, the issue is GPU. The system does take on the initial data backload substantial GPU processing power. And many health systems, the larger ones, have GPU on-prem. None of them are fully on the cloud. Most are on hybrid. So that does mean the smaller healthcare organizations who don't have a lot of available processing power at the moment, if there's no GPU, there's no AI. And, you know, that is not just a healthcare problem. That's a global problem. It's hard to get a hold of GPU. They're scarce and they're expensive. So that is an issue where the GPU is availability is a limiting factor of who can get in on this, you know, at this stage of the technology development.
Yeah, and I'll jump in to say that, like, at the end of the day, and I'm coming back to Priya's question as well, or this is pertinent to Priya's question as well, is to say that at the end of the day, this ends up being like a statistical probability problem, right? So the more patients you're trying to match to the more trials, the more likely you are to be able to find, or the more viable trials, meaning local and accessible and active and those kinds of things, then the more likely you are to find viable matches. So the smaller the patient population and the smaller the number of trials that you're considering, then the fewer matches you're likely to identify as well. So that's one way of thinking about it. And in some ways, like I always think about being like, you know, idealistically, and I'm totally going to oversimplify here, if I'm looking for a number of patients from a large general practice indication, like type 2 diabetes, for example, and I'm looking for patients that are kind of everywhere, how do I identify those patients that are everywhere that may be eligible for moving into a trial? And there are some large language model approaches that are even happening now that are trying to detect not only all of those type 2 diabetes patients, which are, you know, plentiful, but which of the type 2 diabetes patients are moving towards being ready to consider another care option. Or on the other end of the spectrum, the kind of needle in a haystack patient, the patient that's got a very unique biomarker profile, for example, and a clinical trial who's looking for a very unique patient. So, you know, how can those two strangers in the night, you know, find one another? And those kind of two scenarios are kind of optimum. There's like a million viable and very, you know, important stops between those two ends of the spectrum. But it's sort of one lens to look at these solutions through.
Brendan, I'd love to come back to you with the Freakonomics, economic incentive question, because with a patient-centric platform, it seems like, you know, it would be a challenge for an innovator to have a sustainable source of revenue. So how do you balance studies and opportunities to generate revenue while also sharing all potential matches with an interested patient?
Yeah, it's a great question, Greg. It's funny, right? Like this question of potentially misaligned incentives. I actually don't know if there are misaligned incentives here. But the kind of like scenario that's challenging here is one that's like time bound. So if you think of like a platform like ours at scale, right? Like a Zillow at scale or like an Airbnb at scale. Like at scale, like these like misalignments actually go away because you have so much participation on platform. The question is, okay, like how do we get from like here to there, right? and how do you build kind of a sustainable business model along the way that encourages us to kind of get to where we want to go. You know, one of the ways that we found to be really compelling and we're really excited about is actually introducing introducing patient assistance services almost on behalf of the sponsors that we might partner with. I'll give you an example, right? We're solving what we call the out-of-network patient recruitment problem, which is, hey, 90% of patients that probably don't know your PIs in your cities. You know, they're just so many patients and like so many PIs. 90% of them probably don't know these PIs, and we call them these out-of-network patients. One of the biggest barriers for an out-of-network patient to actually get into a study is the transfer of medical records, right? That can introduce 30 to 60 days in the process. And then at that point, you know, most patients have lost interest after initially considering the study. So one of the things that we might do with some of our sponsors that we work with is, well, for the out-of-network patients that are interested in your study, can we help collect medical records on your site's behalf? And the answer is yes, we can do it in less than a day. And when we do so, it unlocks a tremendous amount of conversion at the site. It saves a lot of time for the sites who are not only scanning these records but also trying to collect these records. I mean, that's kind of like a value added offering that sponsors are more than happy to kind of pay for it and work with us on.
So it's a little bit enriched then. So the patient theoretically should be able to see all of their potential trials for which they match, but there may be some that have some enriched services that can better facilitate moving them through the funnel and closing that loop to actually being a qualified referral, maybe even a randomized participant.
Totally. It's all about adding these enriched services that increase the probability of success, increase the conversion rate, and then the time to success, right? And those are the two critical factors.
My ask for you here, Brandon, might be if I'm a participant going through that process and I screen fail for that sponsor trial, can I get back the data that you collected on me so that we can use it to find the next study, even if it's with a different sponsor?
Oh, absolutely. So, what ends up happening is, you know, patients, when they sign up on Power, they're kind of prompted to kind of consent for us to collect their records on their behalf to kind of support in their journey. And those records that we collect on their behalf end up getting, you know, appended to their profile, so to speak. So you can imagine almost this, like, this dossier for the patient that we're starting to collect, to enrich, their kind of application profile for each subsequent trial as well.
Now, one thing I know Todd notes in his paper is CT.gov, which I'm assuming you have to rely on for some of the studies that you're showing me, doesn't necessarily know which sites may still be enrolling which subgroups of patients. Maybe they've already filled all of their slots for someone like me, but you don't necessarily get visibility to that unless they're kind of a partnered site or through a partnered sponsor. How can we close that loop so we're not setting an expectation of hope where that site may actually be at capacity?
Yeah, you know, you've kind of touched on an important part, which is the more participation we get from sites and from sponsors, the better information we can present to patients. So that's a big part of why we're working so hard to make tooling so that it's phenomenally easy to kind of update the information on our platform.
Todd, should that be a part of an open platform, sort of an API that every referral channel can hit to better improve chances of actually closing the loop?
Sure.
Then that would be ideal. That'd be great. But there's a big but coming here as well, which is, you know, it's one thing to be able to have access to that site contact information and the right site contact information for the right trial. Because quite often, you know, within a healthcare institution, it may be one particular coordinator who knows what needs to be known about a particular trial to be able to identify and recognize that patient, right? So even if I find the right number and or email address and contact that person, it may be difficult to move sort of between trials, even within that same correct location. And then at the end of the day, like, it kind of gets boring that, you know, at the end of the day, the final bottleneck that really matters the most here is kind of the coordinator capacity to finish, to have that good conversation with a patient who's thinking that this might be an option, to be able to complete the assessment and the transaction and the evaluation about whether or not the patient is actually, you know, suitable for that particular trial and vice versa.
I see we have our friend Archana here on the stage with us. Archana, feel free to come off mute, reintroduce yourself for folks who haven't had the pleasure, and share your thoughts on today's topic.
Hi, thank you for bringing me on stage. My name is Archana Sah, and I'm an independent advisor to the industry on various topics ranging from clinical development to digital health, having spent the past 30 years in the industry. Great to see some of my ex-colleagues. Hi, Todd. hi, Jane. Well, we just talked an hour ago, so good to see you again. My question is for Brandon, and the question I had was, majority of the patients, as we know, reside in the community setting in the rural areas, not closer to the large centers that do these research. So I'm coming from an angle of patient referrals. I noticed in the chat you said that you know, some of the doctors are trying to refer their patients to your website. You know, because the majority of the patients are in that community setting, are you also looking to tap into getting these, you know, education, number one, about the options and about your platform amongst these rural and community physicians so that they can refer their patients as well? And B, is there opportunity for you to get them to be, you know, to be sort of a referring physicians and get paid in return for referring patients?
I love that you brought this up, Archana. So this kind of goes back to the framework that I was alluding to, which is we think of patient recruitment in two kind of categories. There's in-network patient recruitment. So that's a lot of the stuff that Jennifer is leading, right? Like, how do you like more effectively recruit the patients that are already established at the site? And then there's out-of-network patient recruitment, all the others, right? The community, the patients who see community physicians who don't know your PIs. So we want to be in that space of out-of-network patient recruitment. I'll kind of like go back to another analogy here in terms of physician referrals. One of the things we're starting to see in terms of physician referrals is that today, if you ask any physician, if they've ever sent a patient to clinicaltrials.gov, they'll kind of say yes with like a kind of like acknowledgement, a somber acknowledgement that it probably wasn't like a great experience for that individual. And then what we found is that as physicians learn about Power and start using our website, they realize, oh, there's a product out there that solves this problem in a way that's far more compelling from a user experience standpoint. So we're seeing that physicians are just sending patients to our website, our URL, because it's a better end user experience. It's kind of like how brokers started sending buyers to Zillow in a real estate setting when they realized there was a better solution there. But then I love what you've just kind of called out, which is, okay, well, then how can we like start making sure that those referring physicians get fairly compensated for the kind of work they're doing? And that's kind of hinting at something on our product roadmap, which I'm really excited about, which is how do you empower sites, clinical trial sites, to build their own referral networks and facilitate the kind of fair market value compensation to their referral networks. We're really excited about this idea.
Hey, we've got just a couple minutes left, and I know I had technical issues getting her up on stage. Michelle Sjogren here with us. Michelle, in just a couple of minutes left, come off mute, share your question or perspective on today's topic.
Yeah, so thank you for bringing me up. I have worked on the clinical trial awareness topic now for multiple years. I helped with the Bayer trial finder, trying to make it more patient friendly, and also worked on the registry of the future through Transcelerate. And one of the biggest things was around this economics kind of side of things and the ethical side of whether or not, if we have, you know, some of those that look different and feel different, is that really providing the best service to the patient? Because if you see more flashy things, or you see something that is just easier to read, of course you're going to gravitate towards those, but that may not be the best match for you. So I had a discussion in an innovative workshop with someone probably about a year and a half ago, And I suggested that a company come out as a registry company that really was patient focused, but the way that they would sell this to pharma companies to be able to get funding for it would be through their social responsibility budget versus their study budget, because of the fact that everybody complains anything that helps everybody is not easy to track any kind of ROI, or you can't really figure out pass through or those kind of things. But if we're trying to improve clinical trial awareness, that falls under social responsibility. And now with all the sustainability efforts, there's a social responsibility piece as well. So what I'd love to see, and I'm throwing it out there because we have some really smart people to figure out how to do it, is to have something that's truly equitable and inclusive for patients created. And then on top of that, you can have this different form of funding that comes in. And maybe there's another way to also deal with trial matching through more EMR data and those kind of things. But as far as the awareness side of it, maybe that's an option. So just throwing it out there. Thanks.
A couple of quick responses to that, Michelle, and thanks for raising it. There's no question there are a couple of big, very large public-private partnerships that are actually looking at implementing trial matching as a tactic, as one of many tactics to increase, you know, representativeness and inclusive clinical trials as well. I'm thinking about a recent IHI topic call that that I'm involved with responding to, for example. So that's one of the things. I think the other thing that's really interesting here when it comes to clinical trial awareness, it's been interesting to see, you know, aside from some of the, I'll say patient-centric approaches, as I described them before, there's kind of a new sort of meta-universe that's starting to show up as well of different like social media campaigns to raise awareness, as well as even doing like behaviorally informed social media campaigns to pull patients toward those towards some of these matching solutions as well. So it's kind of enabling a broader landscape on top of the landscape as well, all with those sort of right motivations in mind.
Todd, thank you so much. I think that's going to be our last word on the topic today. I want to thank everyone in the audience for jumping in. A great conversation in the chat. Archana and Michelle, thanks for jumping up on stage with us. And of course, our guests today, Todd Georgiev, Brandon Lee, and Jennifer Clausen. Make sure you're following all those folks on LinkedIn or other social platforms. Keep learning from their perspectives. Reach out if you've got follow-up questions. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here this week. Have a great weekend.
Great. Thanks, thank all. Thanks very much.